content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press, Religion News Service, and the News and Observer. Our first article was published by the AP on December 9, written by Matthew Brown and Mark Levy. Biden creates Native American boarding school national monument to mark era of forced assimilation. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. President Joe Biden designated a national monument at a former Native American boarding school in Pennsylvania on December 9 to honor the resilience of indigenous tribes whose children were forced to attend the school and hundreds of similar abusive institutions. The creation of the Carlisle Federal Indian Boarding School National Monument, announced during a tribal leaders' summit at the White House, is intended to confront what Biden referred to as a dark chapter in the nation's history. We're not about erasing history. We're about recognizing history, the good, the bad, and the ugly, Biden said. I don't want people forgetting 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now and pretend it didn't happen. Thousands of Native children passed through the notorious Carlisle Indian Industrial School between 1879 and 1918, including Olympian Jim Thorpe. They came from dozens of tribes under forced assimilation policies that were meant to erase Native American traditions and civilize the children so they would better fit into white society. It was the first school of its type and became a template for a network of government-backed Native American boarding schools that ultimately expanded to at least 37 states and territories. About 7,800 children from more than 140 tribes were sent to Carlisle, stolen from their families, their tribes, and their homelands. It was wrong making the Carlisle Indian School a national model, Biden told the White House summit. Thorpe's great-grandson, James Thorpe Kozakowski, called Biden's designation an important and historic step toward broadening Americans' understanding of the federal government's forced assimilation policy. It's very emotional for me to walk around, to look at the area where my great-grandfather had gone through school, where he had met my great-grandmother, where they were married, where he stayed in his dorm room, where he worked out and trained, Kozakowski, 54, of Elburn, Illinois, said in an interview. The children were often taken against the will of their parents, and an estimated 187 Native American and Alaska Native children died at the institution in Carlisle, including from tuberculosis and other diseases. Their ongoing efforts to return the children's remains, which were buried on the school's grounds, to their homelands. They represent 50 tribal nations from Alaska to New Mexico to New York, and I think that symbolizes how horrific Carlisle was, said Beth Margaret Wright, a Native American Rights Fund lawyer. She has represented tribes trying to get the Army to return their children's remains and is a member of the Pueblo of Laguna, which has children still buried there. Carlisle was a model for many other schools that came after it, and a huge majority of tribal nations that exist today have stories of their children being sent to Carlisle, Wright said. In September, the remains of three children who died at Carlisle were disinterred and returned to the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation in Montana. At least 973 Native American children died at government-funded boarding schools that operated for more than 150 years, according to an Interior Department investigation. During a dozen public listening sessions over the past several years, hosted by the Interior Department, survivors of the schools recall being beaten, forced to cut their hair, and punished for using their native language. The forced assimilation policy officially ended with the enactment of the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978. But the government never fully investigated the boarding school system until the Biden administration. Biden in October apologized on behalf of the U.S. government for the schools and the policies that supported them. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, whose grandparents were taken to boarding school against their family's will, said no single action would adequately address the harms caused by the schools. But she said the administration's efforts have made a difference, and the new monument would allow the American people to learn more about the government's harmful policies. This trauma is not new to Indigenous people, but it is new for many people in our nation, Haaland said. The schools, similar institutions, and related assimilation programs were funded by a total of $23.3 billion in inflation-adjusted federal spending, officials determined. Religious and private institutions that ran many of the schools received federal money as partners in the assimilation campaign. Monday's announcement marks the seventh national monument created by Biden, who has also altered or enlarged several others. In 2021, he restored the boundaries of two monuments, Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, on land in southern Utah, that's sacred to tribes after the monuments were shrunk under former President Donald Trump. The 25-acre site in central Pennsylvania will be managed by the National Park Service and the U.S. Army. The site is part of the campus of the U.S. Army War College. For Wright, one of the most powerful places at the Carlisle School are the imprints of since-removed tracks for trains that delivered children there. There's no longer train tracks there, but you can see where they might have been and where their children would have arrived for the first time and seen a place so far away and seen a place so horrific, Wright said. Native American tribes and conservation groups are pressing for more monument designations before Biden leaves office. Next, we have an article from the Religion News Service published on December 6, written by Fiona Murphy. A 40-year-old Christian commune faces an uncertain time. Hardwick, Massachusetts. As fall shifts into winter in Hardwick, Massachusetts, temperatures are unseasonably high for November, and a 34-acre community built by a homesteading couple nearly four decades ago stands remarkably quiet. I'm finding it's okay for me to say, well, maybe this will not thrive, Suzanne Shanley, co-founder of the Catholic Residential Agape Community, said. It's really left in the hands of God, eventually, whatever that might mean. Lifelong teachers and peace activist, Catholic Suzanne and Brayton Shanley, age 79 and 77, have been on this land in central Massachusetts since 1987, when they cleared dense rural New England forest to construct the buildings that would house an intentional lay community, anchored in the principles of nonviolence and sustainability. They named it Agape, inspired by the Greek word for selfless, unconditional love. I was a child of God, all for Jesus, through Gandhi with a smile, Brayton said. That is how it started out. In the commune's heyday, hundreds of volunteers and community members attended its annual events and work days, which entailed planting crops, chopping wood, and helping prepare the land for the coming season. Centered on two sustainable houses, one large garden and a small hermitage, it has functioned as a combination lay monastery, retreat center, and commune. Most of the food served at Agape, exclusively vegan, is grown on the land. The largest community house, Francis House, has six bedrooms, a chapel, a kitchen, an office, and a wood-burning fireplace. The other house, Bridget House, is insulated with straw bales and serves as the Shanley's residence. This is not our small contribution to things like climate change, we hope. A little oasis here in the woods of Hardwick, Suzanne said. But since 2020, participation has dropped dramatically, leaving the elderly couple to manage the land on their own. And the Shanleys have begun to worry about Agape's future. We're limping, Brayton said. We lost three colleges who don't have a program with us anymore. Volunteering is down overall. Stonehill College and the College of the Holy Cross, Catholic colleges a short drive away, used to send student volunteers to Agape through their campus ministry programs, but no longer do so. Volunteer retreats to the commune have typically involved up to 20 participants, including campus ministries, WWOOF, Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms, volunteers who work on organic farms in exchange for food and lodging, or rural immersion groups that stay for days or weeks at a time. Many long-time visitors still attend its annual Interfaith Francis Day celebration. In the past, the event has attracted prominent speakers such as peace activist Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, and Victor Lewis, a speechwriter for the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Their homestead relies on a combination of donations and revenue from retreat programs. Volunteers help with essential tasks to keep the commune running, such as planting and harvesting food, preserving produce, and chopping firewood for heat during the winter. In past summers, up to 6 volunteers have resided at Agape to perform this labor. This year, only 1 volunteer stayed to help. In the 1960s and 70s, thousands of intentional communities cropped up across the U.S., embracing sustainability, collective living, and personal transformation. In most cases, participation was free or in exchange for work, reflecting the community's ideals of rebellion against materialism. Timothy Miller, a scholar of religious studies at the University of Kansas, said, "While these communities flourished in the mid-20th century, urban and rural, many have seen significant membership declines. Communes have to attract new members to stay alive. And it's pretty clear that most communally minded young adults prefer to start new communities rather than join established ones," he said. Agape is not alone in seeing change. Suzanne said that she had hoped by this stage in her life, Agape would be populated with other homesteaders and peace-minded individuals. "It wasn't a stated goal, but we were always saying to people, come and join," Suzanne said. "A real lingering question in my mind is, will this kind of community be relevant to the younger generation?" The Shanleys are looking at members of the community for guidance. Jim Robinson, 34, a lecturer at Iona University who writes about the intersection of theology and ecology, said he felt an immediate calling to Agape when he first met Brayton and Suzanne at an academic conference at Harvard Divinity School in 2016. "I was struck by a sense that they were authentically living what I was thinking about," Robinson said. "They were living a form of Catholicism that is oriented toward care for creation and radical resistance to systems of violence." For 8 years, Robinson has remained a consistent visitor, often volunteering on the community's mission council, which helps guide Agape's operations. Robinson does not, however, feel called to stay at the commune long term. "I like being involved in multiple communities," Robinson said. "I think there will be a lot of people who have a stance similar to mine." Some longtime visitors to Agape say the challenge lies in stepping into the considerable legacy of Brayton and Suzanne. One of the dangers of strong leadership is replacement, Skip Scheel, an activist and photographer who helped Brayton survey the land for Agape nearly 50 years ago, said. Brayton and Suzanne are unique people. Before retreating to the quiet woods of rural Massachusetts, the Shanleys lived in a once-condemned two-bedroom house they bought in working-class Brockton, not far from Agape. They took in vulnerable people while working as part-time lecturers of peace and nonviolence at Catholic high schools around the state. Over the years, they have gone head-to-head with the IRS, refusing to pay taxes to protest war. Through a connection with Mother Teresa, they helped move a man off death row. At Agape, they have sheltered victims of war and the criminal justice system, held retreats for Muslim communities after 9/11, built a vegetable oil-powered vehicle, and constructed composting toilets in 2016. They traveled to Standing Rock, South Dakota, to join the protest against the proposed oil pipeline there. They continue to host vigils in a town near Agape for the people who have died in Palestine since October 7, 2023. Agape has maintained relationships with nearby intentional communities for many years, such as the Sirius Community, an eco-village and retreat center in Shutesbury, and Noonday Farm, a Catholic worker-affiliated organic farm in Winchedon. At Sirius, founded in 1978, members can rent homes or stay in the main house for internship programs or as full-time residents. I think I grew into understanding the importance of being a peacemaker, and Suzanne and Brayton have been important mentors for me. Janelle Wheeler, a 28-year-old educator and lifelong Agape member, said. Wheeler, who said she's been visiting Agape since she was a baby, serves on the group's mission council. She doesn't plan to move to Agape because she teaches at Montclair State University, a four-hour drive away in New Jersey. But she has hope for the community, suspecting Agape and spaces like it will become vital as young people face a world marked by climate change, war, and social instability. There's a yearning for places like Agape that I feel from my friends. And I think there's a spiritual yearning among them too, Wheeler said. For Brayton and Suzanne, the search continues for volunteers and what they refer to as transition people, individuals who can step in and enable the couple to take on a less hands-on role. I feel that I've been true to a vision that really captivated me and still does, Suzanne said. I just hope for enough physical strength and endurance to live to see something new emerge. Now an article from the Religion News Service published on December 6, written by Adele M. Banks. Obama makes plea for pluralism, citing interfaith partnerships, megachurches. Former President Barack Obama, at a forum on democracy, pointed to the partnership of houses of worship and the success of megachurches as examples of ways to build bridges and foster pluralism. The pluralist ideal is what allows a Christian church and Muslim mosque to sit side by side on the same city block, and then maybe agree to sharing a parking lot, Obama said on December 5 at the Obama Foundation's Democracy Forum in Chicago. He acknowledged that the work of pluralism, or finding ways to live alongside individuals and groups who are different than us, is not easy and takes time. Pluralism is not about holding hands and singing Kumbaya, he said in his remarks, which were posted on Medium. And building bridges may require you to deal with people who not only disagree with you, but do not respect you. He said he experienced that as a president, where I was negotiating with people who made it pretty clear they didn't think I should be president, legally, morally. But he said he and they strove, nevertheless, to listen, foster relationships, and find compromise. Obama also said pluralism does not mandate a denial of people's unique circumstances, but does call for understanding the possibility of a win-win situation rather than a zero-sum situation. He cited the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. as an example of working toward justice with an emphasis on we rather than them or us. That's what King understood in framing the issue, not simply as an African-American issue, but as an American issue, Obama said. We have to acknowledge that we all have multiple identities. I'm a 63-year-old African-American man, for example, but I'm also a husband, I'm a father, and a Christian who's constantly wrestling with doubt about organized religion. The 44th U.S. president said pluralism is successful when it reflects action and not just words. What does build trust, because it builds relationships, is people banding together to get stuff done, he said. Whether it's a mosque and a synagogue joining forces to help victims of a natural disaster, or a black community linking up with a traditionally hostile white community in Chicago to try and stop a highway from running through both neighborhoods. Obama suggested ways to develop the practice of pluralism, including starting groups where children or adults can work together on particular actions. Obama cited the nation's megachurches as an example, inserting a bit of humor as he described some of the nation's largest congregations. If you show up at one of these churches, they don't start off peppering you with questions about whether you've accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, he said. They don't quiz you on the Bible. They invite you in, introduce you around, give you something to eat, tell you all about activities and groups you can be a part of. From the Young Adult Social Club, to the Ballroom Dance Group, to the Men's Choir, which, for those of you not familiar, that's where they put folks whose voices aren't quite good enough to be in the main choir, but who are allowed to perform maybe once every fourth Sunday. He said that big tent philosophy could be instructive. The point is, megachurches are built around, let's get you in here doing stuff, meeting people, and showing you how you can participate and be active. Once that happens, then they can have a deeper conversation about faith in a way that folks aren't spooked by. While his remarks were specifically about the U.S., Obama noted that the American democracy is not the only one in need of bridge building. The fault lines of division may be regional and linguistic, like they are in Spain, or religious, as they are in India and Northern Ireland, or ethnic, as they are in my father's homeland of Kenya, he said. But no matter what country we're talking about, the same basic question remains. Can the idea of pluralism work in the current moment? And for that matter, is the concept even worth saving? I believe the answer is yes. Now an excerpt from an article published by the News and Observer on December 11, written by Avi Bajpai. Moral Monday protest in Raleigh against GOP power shift bill. Leading a large protest Monday, the Reverend William Barber railed against GOP lawmakers' efforts to take away powers from the incoming governor and other top Democrats elected last month, calling the bill a legislative coup. Barber, who spoke against the bill during a news conference at the General Assembly last month, held the latest Moral Monday demonstration at the nearby state capitol. The GOP bill, which was written in secret and quickly rolled out last month, pairs some additional Hurricane Helene relief for western North Carolina with a number of sweeping provisions that would take away and change powers belonging to the governor, attorney general, state superintendent of public instruction, and other statewide elected offices that were won by Democrats in November. Calling the bill a damnable moral shame, Barber said that Republicans were trying to steal power from the people, while those hit by the storm are still hurting. He likened the proposed power shifts to a political hurricane that will tear up the democracy, and rallied the crowd as he rattled off the statewide offices Republicans lost last month and said voters had spoken. Supporters cheered as he told Republicans to leave our democracy the hell alone and led chants of, "We don't need a disastrous bill, we need a bill for the disaster." Vicky Maith, the executive director of Just Economics, said she took a bus from Asheville to speak at Monday's protest. Meath said she had run out of adjectives to describe the devastation in western North Carolina. "It's painful to live through the worst disaster in North Carolina's recorded history, and then to have our pain and devastation used as a front for a bill that does not deliver the needed aid to my community," Meath said. "That bill does not deliver the needed aid to my community, but rather it subverts our democracy, is a power grab, and ignores the will of the people. That is a slap in the face to western North Carolina. We see what you are doing, and we will not forget," she said. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen again next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.